Daniel Brun, cut, carve, engrave.
Hector Zamora, stuck inflatable zeppelin. Installation of bars, Andrei Cădere, round bars of wood. 1970-1971.
All at Once, 55th Venice Biennale, 2013.
Hello, how did you get here?
The Vaporetto stops on the waterfront of Giudecca. We are here to meet Dora Garcia and see her last film, The Joycean Society, a portrait of a book club dedicated to James Joyce Finnegan's Wake, the most difficult book in the world, the most addictive reading experience, if you know how to read it. Facing many times the failure, always giving up with Joyce's books, I ask her when she did first encounter him as a writer, and she says, "When I was an art student, everybody in my class read a portrait of the artist as a young man. And then, after the Dubliners, as many of us, she started reading Ulysses, but she gave up."
And this was when I was in my late teens. And then many years later, so there were different tryouts in between, picking up the Ulysses where I left, but I never... did also because I had a lot to read next to that and it just took too much time. Then I made this film, The Debian Majority, that was following Basaglia legacy in Trieste. So I started in Trieste. And when I was in Trieste talking to different people, then I interviewed actually a psychoanalyst that was supposed to be the granddaughter of Amalia Popper, that was supposed to be a kind of fling that Joyce had in Trieste and for who he wrote Giacomo Joyce, which was a book I didn't know that it existed. It was the only book he wrote in Italian. I was curious because this put me to the track of the relation of Joyce with psychoanalysis. And through different ways, I came to know the people of Summer Joyce School in Trieste. And then there I met Fritz Seng, who is the chief of the reading group, Finnegan's Wake reading group in Zurich, that is the people that are in the film. And so through talking to them, then they, well, you know, first thing is that, well, if you could not read the Ulysses, if you found Ulysses hard, wait until you read the Finnegan's Wake. And so I was curious, and then I went to one of these readings, and I was completely fascinated by this thing. I kind of felt myself very much at ease. Do you feel at home? I thought I should read, before I dare to encounter the Finnegan's Wake, I should finish my Ulysses. I discovered this thing that is called secondary literature. So like Anthony Burgess would guide you through Finnegan's Wake, and there are also a lot of books that tell you how you should read Ulysses, because there's so many references that as a kind of a single reader, you get kind of disconcerted. And so I managed to read Ulysses, and then I started to read the Finnegan's Wake. And I read it, actually, I discovered after 7 sessions with these people, I discovered that it was actually quite easy to read, if you know how. It's very touching. It is addictive, and sometimes it can get almost to extreme levels of addictions. I met people here who tells me that they never read anything that has been written after 1941, because it couldn't have any influence on Joyce, so why bother? For them, I mean, I didn't get to this point yet, but for them, everything else pales in comparison. And actually, what you understand also is that Joyce always wrote the same book. It was just one big book that was seen from different angles. So the characters of Portrait of the Artist appear in Ulysses, the characters of Ulysses appear again in Finnegan's Wake. So it is a kind of a big book. And the last words of Ulysses, which is this yes, of Molly Bloom, is also the beginning of the Finnegan's Wake. You kind of, I understand it enough to enjoy. So it's a kind of path that you have to follow. So that's why it's important to finish it. I mean, no one is going to happen if you don't finish it. Of course, you won't get a fine. But I think for true enjoyment, it's important to follow this. In the case of Phineas Wake, I have started in the Anna Livia Plurabelle chapter. That was the ones that they were reading when I came. And so I haven't read the beginning, for instance.
Well, you know, don't you, Kenneth, or haven't I told you, every telling has a tailing, and that's the he and the she of it. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold chair's gone ashy. Feel-o, feel-o. What age is that? It soon is late.
And so I think it was in 1986, basically the second year, when we thought, well, let's try Finnegan's Wake. If not enough people show up, we stop. But people came, and obviously it serves a need. And so we did it. No idea where we were going, and it took us, as you can see with the slow speed we have, sentence by sentence, it took us something like 11 years to get through. In the meantime, more people came, some left. Now, after 11 years, you can't just say, now go home. So we continued, of course, and of course it's the book for continuation. And so we are now in our third lap.
So they go there since 1986. They have conquered their time to read. Isn't that a political act of resistance?
You can say everything is in Finnegan's Wake. So in a way, it's a book that some people compare it to a Rorschach test. So that means that you can see anything that is in your mind at that moment. So any name, any person, it's like everything is in that book. So in that sense, it's a maximum condensation. It's almost like a vortex or the Aleph, as in this kind of images of places where everything is contained. So that makes that the act of deciphering it is very much like deciphering the sense of the world. Joyce really followed, for instance, the Book of the Dead, Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Bible, and lots of the Bible, but the Quran as well. And then the way it is written with this the meaning is never exhausted, it makes you think very much of holy readings, with the difference, because someone told me as well, for instance, that people who study the Torah, the moment they finish, they have to start immediately from the beginning because they consider an impious act to consider that they have finished. So that would mean that they have understood, and that's fine. You have to start again because there is a never learning process is never ending, and you never stop understanding. So this is very much in the idea of the Finnegan's Wake, with the difference that it's really not a holy book at all, in the sense that it is very dirty. There is a lot of, it's all the time talking about sexuality is impregnating it all over. And it is also very irreverent to power and et cetera. So it is a lot of jokes and a lot of nursery rhymes, jingles. Very much is the action is developed in a tavern. And then it's a lot of alcohol and drinking, et cetera. So it is really not about holiness at all. So the fact that there is people who somehow found the sense of things in a thing like that, and to give sense to things is a political act, but also to refuse to do something that could be considered productive in the standard terms is something very political. So that's what I mean, that I feel myself very much, I have a recognition in this idea. Then you immediately enter the same hierarchy, because, as they say, you don't really have to know anything to read the Finnegan's Wake. You don't even have to speak English very well, which is a common misunderstanding, that you have to be a super, superb English speaker to read Finnegan's Wake. It's not true. There's a lot of languages in Finnegan's Wake. If you are Swedish, you have a lot of advantage. If you are Spanish, you have some advantage. If you are Italian, certainly, even if you are Tristino, have a lot of possibilities that English of grasping things that English people will never grasp. So this is what is very interesting in this book. Yeah.
The only thing... He was tempted at moments, for instance, in 1926 and again in the 30s, to give it up. And there was even talk at some point where he has a friend, another Irish writer, James Stephens, who is going to take over from him. And he says, Joyce says, well, it's just a number of rules. And if you know the rules, you know anybody can do this, which is really, really strange, as if it is a mechanism, a kind of machine that, like a car, where it doesn't matter who is driving, which is difficult if you look at how he was actually doing it.
10 kerchiefs, 9 to hold to the fire and 1 for the code, the convent napkins, 12. 1 baby shawl.
There's only one letter to our friends where he translated the first paragraph, translated into English, the first paragraph. Apart from that, I think he never provided any special. He worked on the translations into Italian and he collaborated in the translation into French. There are many people who think you should not translate the Finnegan's Wake because you should first translate it into English before translating it into anything else. I have read with a lot of interest the French translation. It's a different book altogether because it is like there's something as a strange feeling you have when you read the Finnegan's Wake is that it's a kind of many-dimensional work. It's almost like a polyhedron, and when you translate it, it gets flat. When you read it, what you realize is that it is repeats a lot. There are a lot of characters that pop up all the time. There is a plot, even if it's hard to believe when you read the first 4 pages, but there is a story developing. And so in that sense, I think to explain it or to give a guide would mean that there is one way better to read it as other. And I think there is no right or wrong in this. When you go to these readings, anybody comes up with something. And there is a discussion. As you can also see, there is somebody that always finds very far-fetched explanations of obscure medieval philosophers that could be in there. And the others will discuss, we don't think so because blah, blah, blah. But there is never a moment where you can say this is true and this is not true. There is no concept of right interpretation. It's important to understand that it is not a roman à clé, like they say in French, something that you have a plan you will be able to decipher. So it is not a gincana, it is not a crossword, but it is really something meant to enjoy the reading. You should not try to translate it into normal language. This is a mistake that makes that many people give up, I think, because they think they have to extract what it really means. And this is why it is a perfect metaphor. It is an artwork. But you can also say it's a metaphor for artworks, in the sense that you always have, as an artist, you always have sooner or later to answer this question, what do you want to say? I don't understand what you want to say. I don't understand what this work is about, which is for an artist very discouraging, because if you really could say it in straight words, then you would say it in straight words. What you want to say is too complex to put it, to explain. Listen, you can either see the exhibition or I can tell you, and then you don't have to see the exhibition because why should you? So in the sense of how the meaning works in Finnegan's Wake is prototypical, I think, of how the meaning works in artworks, or should work in artworks, or works in good artworks.
It's a piece of cake.
My colonial water bagful.
If you had a chance to see a copy of Finnegan's Wake that belongs to one of the readers, you would understand that to read that book is both a collaborative process and a very intimate experience of self-analysis. The Joyce and Society manages to portray these two aspects and gives a faithful portrait of how the reading sessions go.
I film 3 sessions, but mostly it's the last session I film, because of course you have to follow a bit the order of the text, and I just inserted some sounds from the other film because there were some things said that were important. There were also the plans of the grave of Joyce, because Joyce is buried in Zurich. This is partly why this group was supported by the city. The pub where he met, or a pub that has a relation with Nora Joyce, where she worked as a maid, is actually in Zurich as well. They bought it. They bought it from Ireland. So it's and all in relation to this group. So there was this Fritzen, is the main personality, who's a Joycean, and that's all you need as a presentation card. You're a Joycean. So he was there, and then he managed to save this pub that later became completely estranged from the group anyway. But he also managed to convince a bank to give money to create this center that was mainly his own library of this. And it is important to know that Joyce really wanted to know what was going to happen with this text. Joyce, he wrote his two bigger books, Ulysses and Phineas Wake, in the eve of the World Wars, the first for Ulysses, the second for the Phineas Wake. And he seemed to be always extremely annoyed that people would be hindered from reading his book because they were busy with the war. And then there was, so he was very worried in a way too. In a way, I think the Phineas Wake is a kind of try to save things that might be destroyed by a never-ending series of wars. So I think he was a kind of, he has an urgency to save mankind or culture or something like that in a very modest way, so not in a pretentious or pompous way. So this is one thing. But anyway, this is the reason why the film had to be reduced, because it never could last the 1.5 hours, taking into account that I wanted to insert all these other things. So what is continuous is the sounds. All the way you have the sounds of the people reading and discussing, even when you have the other inserts of things. So, because you have also, there are many elements like the bells, that sounds, etc. So I wanted to create the idea, almost a Finnegan's Wake scene, because in the Finnegan's Wake you have these 12 people that are at the same time the 12 apostles, and that they are drinking in the tavern, and you could understand this as a communion, you know, etc. But also you could understand it as the last shelter of reason, in a way, in the madness of war. That's why I say it is very touching when you learn how to read it, because you can see that there was a man that was older than Ulysses, that was very desperate because of the Europe situation. Not that he really, he had a very peculiar way of being related to politics. In France, with the magazine Tel Quel, Joyce was read in terms of Marxist terms in France. And so there was people who said even that it was the most anti-fascist book ever written, which is a very strange thing to say, because the relation of Joyce with politics is quite a complex one, to Ireland as well, to the feeling of the colonization of Ireland by the English, but also about communism, and it's quite, having sympathies, of course, for the left, he was also wanting to take his distance from it, the same way as having certain sympathy for the avant-garde, he also was not willing to integrate into that. So it's a very curious book. You could, it's never ending, yeah.
That's the perverse part of it, that Joyce programmed it in such a way that he invites you to that kind of religious fervor where you turn it into a holy book that, like, in one of the books that we know Joyce read, it was an introduction to a translation of the Quran, and in the translation he noted, in the introduction to the translation, he noted that every word of the Quran is supposed to have 70 different meanings. And he notes that and then uses it in Finnegan's Wake, where it describes the text. And I think the point that I want to make is that, you know, as an academic writing on Finnegan's Wake, you can note the fact that Joyce thought that he was doing that, or wanted to do that, or wanted to give the impression that he was doing it, but you shouldn't fall for it, or you shouldn't ascribe to the ideology. Just describe the ideology and see how far it would get you. I'm not describing it as something dangerous, but it's of course not dangerous. It's of all possible pathologies, it's one of the most benign ones. You don't go around killing people because you only have 69 meanings for every word of Phineas Wake.
Not that far from Trieste, in Vienna, Freud had invented psychoanalysis, and soon the wave reached the marginal, cosmopolitan, though, Trieste. What was Joyce's relation with Freud and psychoanalysis?
That's a very good question, because actually this is how I came when I interviewed this Ellen Brunner, the granddaughter of Amalia Popper, who's a psychoanalyst. And so she was telling me when Joyce went to Trieste, he was very, very young. Somehow he had in mind this idea of the subconscious. He was a parallel discovery, if you want, to Freud. So he wanted to find a language able to translate what was going on in the mind. That's what he was saying when people were saying Ulysses is dirty because you see people shitting, and it tells things about masturbation, and this is really... And he was saying, but this is what's going on in the mind. you can't deny in the mind is not what the novels tell. What people are thinking about is about I have to pee. Very dirty things. It's very close to the it in Freudian terms. So he was very young. I think he was 22 when he went to Trieste, and he was very occupied with this thing. And then at the same time, exactly at the same time, psychoanalysis arrived in Trieste because Trieste was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the first disciples of Freud were actually Eduardo Weiss, that was a Triestino. And at the moment that Joyce was there, everyone was talking about psychoanalysis. It was the big rage. Everyone was being psychoanalyzed. Svebo was being psychoanalyzed. Joyce refused to be psychoanalyzed. I can imagine that he was quite irritated by this thing because he felt that it was his thing. Especially, it was very much against the idea of interpretation. He said, so it is all very good and it is very interesting, the language of the unconscious, but why do you have to explain it? Why do you have to translate it into something? So he was very, very irritated against Freud, and also he has an enormous concept of himself. So whoever that seemed to be as brilliant as him, he was not very pleased that there were other people that might be as clever as him. So this was this kind of feeling. This is what Ellen Brunner explained to me. But then he wrote Ulysses, and it was relatively a big success. And then in the intermezzo between the First War and the Second War, his daughter Lucia fell ill. And then he started to go through all these health institutions, and he really got to know psychoanalysis in a practical way. And he was, in a way, thinking that it was all a lot of bullshit. But on the other hand, he was desperate to help his daughter, and so he started an even more confrontational, difficult relation to this, especially because, as you know, the opinion of Jung, that was one of the psychoanalysts in Switzerland from Lucia, came to the conclusion that it was all his fault. Lucia was sick because of him and because of his enormous egoism, etc., and what that brought him to being the greatest writer of the 20th century. It was also the same thing that made Lucia very, very sick. So it was quite unbearable for him, as you can imagine, as it would be for any parent. And then in that case, I think the feeling as well is a lot darker because of this difficult circumstance. And so this is the relation of... Then there is a post-mortem relation, which is the Lacanian interpretation of Joyce.
Where now are all her children, say? In kingdom gone, or power to come, or glory be to them father? All alluvial, all alluvial. Some here, more no more. More again lost and a stranger.
What you might consider just difficult language, it has been often compared with schizophrenic speech. The language disorders that are among the symptoms associated with schizophrenia have been found in many avant-garde literature, art and cinema. That's what happened to Joyce and Beckett, among many others. Some psychiatrist couldn't make any difference between dead texts and the case of mental disorder.
I know quite a lot, but it's a very fundamental book for that, about that, which is called Schizophrenic Speech, which deals really with this parallel. And it's a book by a linguist and a psychiatrist. It's a very complex subject because what happens is that indeed there has been experiments in which among the writing of psychotics or people suffering from schizophrenia very specifically was mixed together with text by Beckett or by Joyce to experts that would diagnose according to this, and they had no problem to diagnose them as well and to say that this, they could not see any difference between the what is called schizophrenic speech and a text by Phineas Wake or Molloy, that was the other text that was given of Beckett. So this just proves how silly many experiments are, and how, because the thing is, there is a connection, it's a tradition, there is a long tradition in psychiatry about the connection between madness and creativity. There are different theories about this connection, but we won't go into that now, but there is quite of them are quite convincing. But what is clear by any standards is that Joyce was an extremely sane man. He was probably more sane than anyone you come around. And this was actually the theory of Lacan, that Joyce had was able to create this symptom, the writing of, or Joyce was his symptom that allows the subjectivity to be kept together. And that's why Jung, considered that it was Joy's fault that his daughter didn't have this capacity, but was confronted with the same demons, as to say, and so she just couldn't hold it. I think he used the image that they were swimming in the same river, but while Joyce was swimming upwards, his daughter was swimming downwards. That was the, I think, Jung image to explain to Joyce what was the situation. And so there is what is called the thought disorder, which basically what happens is that the language stops being functional and starts to enjoy itself. You don't really say things to communicate, to get to a practical thing, but you say things because you like how the language sounds and you like because you want to evoke images that cannot be evoked otherwise. So in that way, you could say poetry, any kind of poetry, is also a sort of a schizophrenic speech because it's not useful as language. It just creates a certain image that cannot be reproduced otherwise. So poetry has been said a sort of dysphasia. Every mental disorder is related to language. It produces always a kind of alteration of language. The difference is that, according to some psychiatrists were telling me, the main big difference is that while the text of Wake or Molloy or poetry takes an enormous amount of time to produce and is 100% consciously produced, the text of people suffering from schizophrenia is produced naturally in one go with no apparent effort, and as if it was just the way they speak. So they consider there must be something going on in the brain, and that actually that is where is the answer is for this. Then there are, I will just give a few considerations which I find very curious. Is what, there were some people now, a certain psychiatrist, I cannot remember the name right now, who says that actually schizophrenia is not only a disease, but it is the human disease related to language, and that only can happen with people who have the language, the capacity of language. Every people has the capacity, so it's human in that sense. And it is originated in the same area of the brain where language resides. This is one idea. Another idea is that every creative use of language, creative means to give unusual answers to new problems. This is what is creativity, and that's why it is a very important quality to survive. But this quality, it is what produces poetry on the one hand, any sort of human production, but on the dark side of the moon, it produces madness as well. So it is both things. Creativity has these two sides. People who have schizophrenia rarely reproduce. They don't have the drive to reproduce. They don't, let's say, they don't have the drive to get in a couple, they don't have the capacity to live in a family. They are lonely people. But after thousands and thousands of years, then one wonders why it has not been completely eliminated, if in theory. These people say that it's because the other side of it, the same people who might develop this thing are also the people that are more creative, and that's why it cannot be completely pissed out. This is a theory someone was telling me just recently. I'm still thinking about it because it sounds very, very convincing.
This interview was recorded during the opening days of the 55th Venice Biennale on the Giudecca Island at the Spazio Punch. If you want to listen more from Venice, radiopapesse.org.